Alors bonsoir, bienvenue à toutes et à tous. Je m'appelle Allison Christians et je suis titulaire de la chaire H. Hewitt Stikeman en droit fiscal à la faculté de droit de l'Université McGill. C'est avec grand plaisir que je vous accueille ce soir à cette table ronde pour discuter de la sujet de la justice fiscale. Comme vous le savez sans doute, la question de la justice fiscale est un sujet d'actualité qui fait beaucoup parler. On entend souvent dire que les élites continuent de profiter du système pour payer moins d'impôts. Et on pense même que le gouvernement ferme les yeux devant cette réalité. En même temps, on remarque une crise économique mondiale accompagnée d'un taux de chômage élevé et plusieurs problèmes sociaux. Mais on voit que les gouvernements répondent avec des politiques d'austérité. Ils parlent de crise, ils parlent de sacrifice, mais ils pensent régler le problème en faisant des coupures budgétaires qui affectent gravement les plus démunis. Face à cette problématique, on se demande si la justice est un principe oublié, même si elle constitue la base du système fiscal. C'est sur cette question que les conférenciers vont se pencher. Avant de commencer, je veux remercier Dennis Howlett of Canadians for Tax Fairness et Peter Gillespie. Where did he go? Je ne sais pas. Ah, voilà, merci. Of the Halifax Initiative, les organisateurs de cet événement. Je voudrais aussi souligner le soutien de la faculté de droit de l'Université McGill, the Halifax Initiative, Canadians for Tax Fairness, Stikeman Elliott, InterParis, la Centrale des syndicats du Québec, le Centre canadien de politique alternative et sans oublier le Progressive Economics Forum. Nous vous prions d'attendre à la fin si vous voulez vous exprimer sur le sujet. Pour faciliter les échanges, il y a un micro dans l'allée à votre disposition. Maintenant, je pense que nous sommes prêts. Et sans plus attendre, je vous présente notre premier conférencier, John Christensen. Il est le directeur du Tax Justice Network et l'auteur de nombreux textes de la justice fiscale, reconnus à l'échelle nationale ainsi qu'internationale. S'il vous plaît, veuillez l'accueillir chaleureusement.
Thank you very much. I'll be speaking in English, but thank you very much indeed for inviting me. And well done for turning up on an evening to come and talk about tax justice. But tax justice is, of course, the issue of the moment. For those of you who follow G8 and the OECD, we have managed to put tax up at the top of the international agenda, which is precisely where it belongs. Because if you look at the history of economic justice, you can track economic justice through the tax codes of every country of the world going back through many centuries. And we can now, after 30 years of globalization, judge the success of globalization and the success of the audacious project of neoliberalism, and find it very lacking, and it's particularly lacking in the tax codes. There are fundamental failures. And finally, G8, OECD, and G20 are recognizing that the tax rules we have in place are not fit for purpose, and never were, really. They're not fit for purpose because our wealthiest elites can use tax havens to avoid and evade tax. They're not fit for purpose because our transnational corporations can, as Apple shows very clearly, can pretend that they have companies registered nowhere and everywhere, a bit like the Cheshire Cat. And they can literally turn around to the most powerful country in the world and say, if you bring the tax rates down to the level we're prepared to pay, then we will pay tax. And this raises a really fundamental problem for all of us. How can we run a democracy of any kind where we have control over taxing rights when powerful corporations like Apple and others can determine whether or not they will pay tax and on what terms? So I think we've got to stand back a little bit and look at what kind of globalization do we want. Do we want to have a globalization where corporates rule the world? We had that in the 1930s. We had the rise of the corporate state in Europe, and we know the consequences. It's called fascism. And we must be very, very aware of the dangers that that poses. Particularly now that 4 years into this radical program of austerity, it is quite clear that austerity has failed dramatically. And that's one of the reasons why the British Prime Minister, the president of G8, has come forward and said very publicly at the beginning of this year, we must now tackle the whole issue of tax havens. We must tackle the whole issue of the way that corporates are taxed. And he's actually pinned a great deal of his credibility as G8 president on tackling precisely those issues. And of course, I welcome that. I welcome it because these issues need to be handled at many levels, but above all, it needs to have an organization with the political power of G8 to push forward the necessary changes. David Cameron came to this a little bit late, but that's always welcome, and it's particularly welcome when conservatives like David Cameron, who very clearly says, I am a low-tax conservative, says, at the same time, I am deeply concerned about the market distortions that arise, that are caused by tax havens, that are caused by the way in which some companies, mainly transnational corporations, can avoid tax, whilst other companies, small and medium enterprises, obviously can't use tax havens and have to pay the taxes. And this is a massive market distortion and a reason why I'd suggest to you that all conservatives, all real conservatives, should be working with us on the tax justice movement. But there are other forces at play which I think we should all be aware of, one of which is that the rules of the game, the rules set by the OECD, which acknowledged earlier this year, finally, after years and years of us hammering away at them, that tax avoidance is a chronic and systemic problem, and they are now planning to address that through their base erosion and profit shifting program. They've acknowledged it only because of the pressure coming from civil society. But there is another force at play which the OECD is aware of, and this is a major geopolitical force, arising from the fact that the rules of the game which the OECD have dominated for so many years no longer, and never have, frankly, suited the emerging powers, by which I mean China and India and South Africa, in other words, the BRICS, who say, look, the arm's length method, which the OECD has been promoting, doesn't work for us. The whole basis of transfer pricing has been rigged from the start. It's intellectually flawed. We sign up to it, but we're applying different rules. And if the OECD doesn't come forward with rules that work, then we run the genuine risk that China, India, and Brazil will go different ways. And we'll have a fragmentation of the global rules, and that can only lead one way, and that's towards tax wars. Back to the bad old days of not just double non-taxation, but double taxation. So there are fears amongst the corporate community as well, that if we do not get this issue sorted of how to tax multinational companies, then we're facing tax wars between China and the United States and so on. We've already had a few cases. I mean, we have some fascinating cases going on through the Indian courts at the moment, spearheaded by my great friend Vodafone. And of course, bringing Vodafone up, of course, reminds me that I'm also not only an economist and with Tax Justice Network, I'm also with UK Uncut. And for those of you who aren't familiar with UK Uncut, it's a grassroots organization working on tax justice, and they've been taking companies like Vodafone and some of the major banks and turning their headquarters into creches and libraries in protest against the austerity thing, but also in protest against the sheer abuse of power of an organization like Vodafone, which thinks that it can do special deals with our senior tax inspectors, which cost Britain close to $6.5 billion of lost revenue, by their ability to manipulate the system, to lobby, to do special deals with Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, which ordinary taxpayers couldn't possibly do. So there is a genuine grassroots concern across Europe, and particularly in Britain. Both of my sons are banned from all sorts of places because they've been sitting down there and protesting. And I'm very proud of them to do this, because this is something where we do need to mobilize public anger, not only because this is an ethical and moral issue, but also because this is an issue which has shaped an economy which does not serve our public interest. Far from globalization leading to the great trickle down which was promised to us in the 1980s, which of course none of us believed in to begin with, globalization has led to incredible levels of inequality which we haven't seen in Europe since the 19th century. And that's partly where the tax havens fit in, and where Jim Henry's work, and he'll tell you more about that, I hope, on how much wealth is hidden offshore, because the sums involved are truly astonishing. Jim's lower end estimate of $21 trillion US of personal wealth held offshore, upper end figure of $32 trillion US, that's only the financial assets side of things, is truly astonishing. And what makes it all the worse is when you recognize that that wealth is not factored into the inequality estimates of anywhere in the world. And that's been confirmed by all the best statisticians and economists working on inequality. In other words, that wealth is totally hidden. Inequality is much, much, much worse than the available Gini coefficients suggest. So we have a much deeper problem, a much more systemic problem than anyone is prepared to accept. And that's why it's important that we now move forward with the agenda that David Cameron is promising us. Now, what he's promising us is, first of all, a move away from the OECD's chronically useless tax information exchange agreements, which is the basis on which the OECD has been negotiating for the last 10 years, towards fully automatic information exchange on a multilateral basis. 5 minutes, thank you. And that is, of course, precisely what we've been pushing for. And it's disappointing that the Canadian government, in its list of recommendations arising out of the House of Commons committee work, is still talking the old language of tax information exchanges on request on the OECD model, because frankly, that model is now finished. It's history. G20 and G8 have moved on to multilateral and automatic information exchange. Please get your government to catch up. The other thing that David Cameron has promised is that we'll move forward with requiring disclosure of beneficial ownership of offshore companies, offshore trusts, and offshore foundations. Now, the reason this is so important is because only what my colleagues in America call the stupid rich actually hold their assets offshore under their own names. Everybody else will be advised by their lawyers to hold their assets offshore, hidden behind offshore companies and offshore trusts and offshore foundations. And if we can't crack that particular issue, we're wasting our time. And that is why Prime Minister Cameron is now telling all of the British Overseas Territories and all of the Crown dependencies, the days of secret offshore companies and offshore trusts are over. We now want full public registry. I'm not sure he's going to go that far, but we, the tax justice movement, demand full public registry of the ownership details. Is this unreasonable to expect? Well, no, quite the opposite. We as society provide people with the facility and the privilege of creating companies and trusts and foundations, and the very least we can expect in return for those privileges is that they disclose a certain amount of information, not least who is actually behind these offshore structures. And I suppose the last area where we hope to see progress, of course, is through the OECD's BEPS process, this base erosion and profit shifting. Now, I'm on the OECD's Tax and Development Task Force and have spent many years suffering the OECD's lack of ambition. It is maybe a graveyard of expectations working with the OECD, because every time they move forward with the lowest common denominator position. The best example of that recently has been these hopeless by request tax information exchange agreements, which cannot work. And why did they come? Where did they come from? They came actually from the Global Forum process, which is dominated by the tax havens themselves. So we must have very low expectations of the OECD, but there's one reason why the OECD now needs to act and act very strongly, and that is because their credibility is on the line. They failed for decades. And when organizations, when China and India and Brazil say, look, if you can't get your rules to work, then we're going to look to elsewhere. We're going to write our own rules. 2 minutes. Then the OECD really has to start taking dramatic action. And the action we want them to move for, they're talking about maybe a bit of strengthening of withholding payments on royalties, some redefinition of permanent establishment rules and stuff like that. It's great. But we need something a little bit more substantive. We want them to move in the direction of combined reporting. We want to have country-by-country reporting as a minimum standard, and we want to start moving in the direction of recognizing that in a world of dominated by transnational corporations, we must shift away from allowing them to pretend that their profits are actually generated in the Cayman Islands when they have a subsidiary there with one person, and that's where all their profits are generated. We want to move beyond the legal fictions to taxing on the basis of genuine economic substance. In other words, where is the labor engaged? Where do the sales actually happen? And where is the capital actually invested? In other words, we want to move towards a unitary basis of taxation based around profits apportionment. Is the OECD ready to do this? I think absolutely not at all. But that's where we want to take them. So that's the big picture that we're hoping to see, and I look forward to hearing, particularly from Jim Henry, I look forward to a good discussion about how we can move forward with this agenda.
Thank you so much, John, for those provocative and interesting opening remarks. The next speaker is actually a video. Alain Denon was not able to be here with us tonight, but he prepared a video to share with us. As some of you know, Alain Denon is a philosopher and the author of Offshore, Tax Havens, and the Rule of Global Crime, among other numerous books. He teaches political science here in Montreal at the University de Montréal, where his research focuses on the impact of tax havens on the functioning of political legislation. And I think my very capable research assistant will take over the technology here to save us from my possible mistake there.
Bonjour, je suis désolé de ne pas pouvoir être des vôtres aujourd'hui. J'aurais quand même voulu par ce biais partager deux ou trois idées sur la question des paradis fiscaux par rapport à l'année qui s'achève. C'est une année importante. Tout récemment, le Consortium international des journalistes d'enquête a rendu public un certain nombre de données appartenant à des banques d'information sur des titulaires de comptes dans les paradis fiscaux. C'est un événement extrêmement important parce que pour la première fois, on prend conscience du phénomène des paradis fiscaux à l'échelle internationale, en même temps. C'est-à-dire que dans différents pays du monde, on se saisit de cette question sur un mode simultané et cela permet au fond d'entrée de jeu de situer cette question comme n'étant pas isolée, mais comme étant mondiale. À partir de là, il devient difficile aujourd'hui pour les États de prétendre que la question des paradis fiscaux est une question si large, si universelle, qu'on ne pourrait pas faire cavalier seul, et ainsi de suite. Là, tout le monde est informé de la même manière, au même moment. Ce qui est important de relever dans ce contexte-là, c'est à quel point les États ont favorisé le développement des paradis fiscaux dans l'histoire et à quel point encore aujourd'hui ils légalisent un grand nombre de placements de capitaux dans les paradis fiscaux. Cela au profit des détenteurs de fortune, des grandes industries et des banques. Au fond, on sait maintenant que les paradis fiscaux ne sont pas et ne doivent pas être réduits à l'affaire de quelques fraudeurs à la marge, mais qu'ils doivent être présentés comme un système étant intégré à l'économie mondiale, puisque, comme on le sait, la moitié des transactions financières internationales passent par les paradis fiscaux. Le Canada, en ce qui nous regarde, est un complice important du système offshore. Seulement en 2011, dans les 6 principales destinations offshore, les Canadiens ont investi, entre guillemets, 140 milliards de dollars. C'est autant de fonds qui ont échappé à notre économie, mais aussi aux institutions fiscales. Mais plus avant encore, en 1980, le Canada a signé un accord de non-double imposition avec la Barbade, ce qui permet aux entreprises de chez nous, petites comme grandes, de placer des actifs à la Barbade et de les rapatrier sans payer d'impôts, ou en payant un impôt minimal, là, qui est celui de la Barbade. Le Canada a signé il y a quelques années un accord de libre-échange avec le Panama qui favorise le blanchiment de fonds issus du narcotrafic qui sont majoritairement concentrés à la Barbade, là, chez nous, dans notre économie. Quelques jours seulement après le déclenchement de cette affaire Offshore Leaks, là, du consortium dont on parlait tout à l'heure, le ministre canadien des Finances, Jim Flaherty, a eu comme initiative de se rendre aux Bermudes pour rassurer les investisseurs des Bermudes en disant qu'en ce qui concerne une de leurs activités de prédilection, à savoir les assurances, le Canada continuerait d'être un partenaire de premier plan. Aujourd'hui encore, à la Banque mondiale et au Fonds monétaire international, le Canada partage son siège avec un collectif de paradis fiscaux qui comprend notamment les Bahamas, Belize, Saint-Kitts et Nevis et d'autres pays qui sont présentés par des observateurs internationaux comme étant souvent des plaques tournantes de la drogue dans la région des Caraïbes. Donc, il y a vraiment lieu de s'inquiéter sur l'intégration du Canada au système des paradis fiscaux. Hein. On sait que si on regarde ce qu'annonce un site internet de France, hein, franceoffshore.fr, qui est un site de courtage qui permet à des Français, à des contribuables français, de contourner le fisc de France et donc de bénéficier des largesses du système offshore, on sait que cette firme-là présente le Canada comme un des paradis fiscaux où on peut aller pour contourner le fisc étranger. Donc notre pays est vraiment intégré au système des paradis fiscaux et on devrait s'en formaliser. On devrait d'autant plus s'en formaliser qu'à l'intérieur même de sa législation, on assiste à des pôles offshore. Je cite seulement un cas, celui de Halifax. Halifax est une ville qui, depuis quelques années, se spécialise dans la défiscalisation du travail comptable d'arrière-boutique de firmes qui sont elles-mêmes enregistrées dans les paradis fiscaux, notamment les Bermudes. Il y a des firmes bermudiennes qui fonctionnent sous le droit des Bermudes, qui délocalisent leur travail d'arrière-boutique comptable à Halifax parce qu'il en coûte moins cher là-bas, dans ce cadre qui est aménagé, d'embaucher la main-d'œuvre qu'aux Bermudes comme telles. Donc, ce sont des points très importants qui doivent s'inscrire dans une logique aussi très large de ce que sont non seulement les paradis fiscaux, mais les autres législations de complaisance, les ports francs, les zones franches, les paradis bancaires, les paradis judiciaires, c'est-à-dire toutes ces législations qui, dans le même secteur d'activité de la vie sociale, visent à attirer des détenteurs de fortune, des investisseurs qui rencontrent chez eux des contraintes. On est dans cet ordre-là et il est vraiment rassurant de voir que cette année, en 2013, on a posé le débat dans un cadre international pour qu'on puisse se mobiliser à l'échelle internationale. Merci.
Well, Alain gave us a lot to think about there and provided a nice segue, I think, to our next speaker, James Henry. As many of you already know, James Henry is a leading economist, attorney, and investigative journalist. He was a founding member of Tax Justice USA, was previously the lead economist for McKinsey, and managed the business development office for GE. Currently, he's a senior analyst, I think, at the Tax Justice Network and heads Sag Harbor Group, a consulting agency. Welcome, James. We're very happy to have you here.
Thanks very much. I'm actually the chairman of the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, which is a spinoff of the Tax Justice Network. We have about 81 NGOs in 37 countries, of which Canada is one, and Dennis is my counterpart, maybe successor as the chairman. The topic here today, I think, is an old one from the standpoint of the U.S. Treasury, which is specifically with respect to Canada. We can talk about Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau, who in 1937 wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, complaining about the fact that wealthy Americans had discovered offshore havens as a way of avoiding the new 3% income tax that the U.S. had imposed in the Great Depression to pay the bills. And he mentioned one of the key havens. There were a couple on the list, but the principal ones were Panama at that time and Newfoundland. So this is a little known. I'm still looking for people who tell me more about that those Newfoundland tax gizmos. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I talked to the former deputy director of the IMF about why it is that organizations like Tax Justice Network, under leadership of people like John, and a handful, comparative speaking, of experts, so-called, economists and accountants and lawyers have kind of gathered together to study this problem over the years. Why is it that we are the ones producing these estimates? We are the ones who are sort of breaking news on either the individual tax evasion offshore or the size of corporate tax evasion. And he said very simply, you know, it's a one-sentence answer. We have a lot of leading tax havens as our members. And that shows you kind of the politics of this, because for decades, the IMF and the World Bank have studied poverty around the world. They have been in charge of economic policy for the planet and studying how to help developing countries in particular, but all of us, really. They've been very involved in Europe recently with economic policy. And yet in this area of tax havens, tax justice, and the impact of missing wealth on inequality, corporate tax dodging, you search in vain for finding anything on these subjects of any value in the entire opus of the IMF or the World Bank, and it's really scandalous. So one of the first demands we've had for these institutions is we actually get them to do some work like that we have been doing. Recently we've seen, you know, what originated, I think, as a objectively impossible movement with impossible demands for things like automatic information exchange, country-by-country reporting, beneficial ownership registration, reform of corporate tax dodging and the offshoring of intellectual property. We've seen that list of impossible demands suddenly explode to the top of the list of the issues that are being considered by the G20, the G8, the OECD, all the world's policy forums. And the question is, how is that possible? How did that happen? Well, one of the things that happened was that we found ourselves in a deep economic crisis, especially in Europe. And so part of the demand for change here is coming from the simple fact that there is more austerity, more budget cutting, you know, growing numbers of people unemployed and in poverty, even in countries that have long taken it for granted that they had figured out advanced capitalism and what to do about it. That's part of the story. I think part of the story is also the fact that we've organized global campaigns, and we've highlighted those campaigns by painful facts. One of the essential elements that we've brought to the table here is data, puzzles, solution to puzzles that people can't dodge. One of the things that we've talked about in the last year is the studies that we've done of offshore wealth, $21 to $32 trillion of financial wealth owned by individuals beyond the reach of tax authorities for the most part. And these numbers have stood up under a lot of ground fire to analysts. My friend Jeffrey Sachs recently took a look at them and said, geez, they're pretty good. They leave out non-financial wealth, real estate, gold, a lot of ships that are held offshore through cross-border holding vehicles. So if anything, they're conservative. They're also conservative because they leave out transfer pricing abuses. We totally put that to one side in our estimates. But if those numbers are correct, that means that the world's wealth, because all of this really belongs to fewer than 10 million people, the inequalities of wealth are substantially higher than what we thought, that they've been growing because this wealth stock grew at about 15 to 16% a year throughout the last decade, even while the rest of the economy was hurting, continue to grow since then. That's one of the painful facts that we've brought to the table here that have prompted a lot of this discussion, in addition to the general atmosphere of needing solutions. So, you know, if we look on the margin, there's lots of other painful facts for us to present, to do. We could do research, and one of the things I want to invite those of you who are economists to take an interest in this area that has never been kind of a legitimate field for economists to look at, the area of tax dodging, you know, especially of the offshore market and its impact. We really need people to wade in. This should be 1,000 PhD dissertations on the various aspects of that. The latest painful fact I noticed was that 20% in the year 2000, for reasons that mystify me, the EU, when it introduced the Eurozone, when they introduced a new currency, decided to issue 500 euro notes. And by now, the demand for 500 euro notes is something on the order of €500 billion. And, you know, this is an old theme. In the United States, I wrote an article in the 70s on how most of U.S. currency was offshore. $100 bills had been picked up offshore and were used widely by organized crime and money launderers and drug dealers. But the euro, rather than taking that experience, went along and copied it and actually introduced a great competitor. And 27% of all of the 500 billion of euros that have been produced were issued by one central bank. Which one? Any idea? Guess? Close, but no, Spain. Spain. And Spain is about 5% of the EU's economy. So I put the puzzle to those of you in the audience who want to study something and track it down. So why is 27% of the euros digested in Spain? Obviously, they're flowing out of Spain. They're not staying there. They must be going elsewhere. But that's the kind of a fact that we notice and pay attention to and try to make an issue of. So we have this sort of recent set of victories. I guess the last thing I want to leave you with is this global alliance that I'm heading up here and working on has a particular interest in issues that are of concern to developing countries. Automatic information exchange, beneficial ownership, these are all important issues for first world countries. And certainly the cleaning up of the offshoring of corporate activity by players like Apple, which is parking 64% of its global profits in Ireland and has negotiated a 2% tax rate for that money. That kind of behavior is very important to first world countries. But when we break down the offshore wealth estimates that we've made for the world, we find that about a third of the offshore wealth, or $9 trillion, comes from low and middle income countries. And if you add that up to the add to that the $6.5 trillion that those countries have of official assets, and then subtract out the $4.5 trillion of debt that they have, they are net lenders to us, the first world, to the tune of about $11 trillion. So a lot of those countries don't have debt problems anymore. Those are the debt problems of the 80s and the 90s. They have tax problems, and they need our help to solve them. Their wealthiest people have moved their money offshore beyond the realm of reach of taxation. And so how do they fund their governments? If you look at a country like Brazil, the top 10% of the income distribution pays less than half of the cost of government. And they've been forced to rely on VAT taxes, on excise taxes, sales taxes, payroll taxes that are unavoidable by the immobile factors of production, the poor and the middle class. So from a standpoint of equality and equity, I think one of the largest, most important issues that we care about is this issue of justice with respect to developing countries and that pathological flow of capital from the third world to the first world. So on the margin, when we look at things like automatic information exchange, when we see countries like Switzerland endorsing it, traditionally one of the largest capitals of offshore havens. We have to be aware that there are lots of games that can be played with things like automatic information exchange. There's a big challenge to develop software and an implementation of systems that's not going to take forever, that will actually work to implement this thing. So similarly with country-by-country reporting and the corporate reforms, all of these, we are just seeing formal endorsements, but what really matters is implementation. And the smart money on the other side is betting that we will get it wrong, that we won't really implement automatic information exchange seriously enough or have platforms that people respect, that there could be security problems. Imagine if countries start exchanging information and somebody hacks the system. You know, it just takes one bad example like that. So we have to be deeply involved in making sure that as we consolidate the progress we're already making and take it to the next level. Because the people on the opposition are incredibly well-represented, powerful global institutions with all kinds of money at stake, and they also have the assistance of many politicians who are providing them with representation without taxation. So, thanks very much, and I'm going to go to Newfoundland and figure out the answer to this problem.
Thank you so much, Jim. I did not know that about Newfoundland, so I guess we have a little work to do here. Our next speaker is Frédéric Zalac. He's a television documentary reporter for CBC and Radio-Canada and appears regularly on The National, Enquête, and Découverte. He's the recipient of several accolades, including the Missioner and the Judith Jasmine Awards, two of Canada's top journalism prizes. Please join me in welcoming Frédéric. Merci.
Bonsoir. J'aimerais vous parler un petit peu de l'histoire derrière la fameuse fuite offshore leaks qui a fait des manchettes au mois d'avril. Je suis membre du consortium international de journalistes d'enquête, la ICIJ, depuis plus d'un an. Et j'ai reçu un coup de téléphone tout simplement au mois d'août de l'année dernière. Et c'était des gens de la CIJ qui sont basés en fait à Washington qui me demandaient si on avait peut-être un intérêt à joindre un projet sur des données du monde des paradis fiscaux. Et on m'a fait parvenir une liste de noms avec des adresses de gens qui étaient au Canada. Et là-dedans, on avait une liste de plus de 400 noms de Canadiens. J'ai passé rapidement à travers ça et des noms inconnus pour la plupart. Ce n'était pas vraiment des gens, des politiciens ou des gens très connus, mais il y avait quelques noms connus là-dedans. Et je me suis rendu à Washington pour commencer à fouiller dans une base de données qui avait été mise à notre disposition là-bas. Alors, pour ceux qui ne sont pas au courant, l'origine de tout ça, c'est un journaliste qui était en Australie, qui a reçu par la poste, après avoir fait des articles et écrit des livres sur les paradis fiscaux, il y a une source avec qui il était en contact, qui a commencé à lui donner de l'information et qui lui a dit un jour, vous allez recevoir quelque chose d'intéressant. Et ce qui est arrivé par la poste, c'était un disque dur avec une quantité incroyable de données là-dessus. Et le journaliste en question, Gerald Ryle, a essayé d'aller voir un peu. Il pouvait voir qu'il y avait de l'information intéressante, mais c'était plusieurs formats de fichiers différents. Tout était pêle-mêle, en fait, sur ce disque dur-là. Il savait qu'il y avait quelque chose d'intéressant, mais il ne pouvait pas vraiment, il n'y avait pas les ressources pour être capable d'aller à fond là-dedans. Alors, de se retrouver comme journaliste tout seul en Australie, avec quelque chose qui contenait 2,5 millions de documents, il ne voyait pas une possibilité pour creuser, mais il voyait le potentiel. Et il y a une opportunité unique qui s'est présentée à lui où le poste de direction de l'ICIJ à Washington s'est ouvert. Il a été approché pour devenir le directeur. Et il a vu ça comme une opportunité extraordinaire pour apporter avec lui ce projet-là et utiliser le réseau de journalistes d'enquête qui se trouve à travers le monde. L'ICIJ compte plus de 160 membres comme moi à travers le monde. Et ce que l'ICIJ a dû faire d'abord, c'est de reconstruire les bases de données telles qu'elles étaient à l'origine. Parce que cette source-là provient de deux firmes qui mettent sur pied des sociétés offshore et des fiducies offshore. Donc, c'est des firmes qui seront les bien nantis qui veulent ouvrir une société offshore vont contacter cette firme-là, vont leur dire, bon, j'aimerais avoir une compagnie qui s'appelle XYZ et j'aimerais qu'elle soit située dans tel paradis fiscal. Et ce qu'il y a dans cette fuite-là, dans le fond, c'est toutes les données internes qu'il y avait sur les serveurs de ces deux firmes-là. Des firmes comme celle-là, il y en a des centaines. Donc, ce qu'il y a, même si la fuite est énorme, ce qu'on a obtenu, dans le fond, c'est une fraction de ce qui existe comme information sur les paradis fiscaux. Donc, Offshore Leaks, ce n'est pas tous les gens qui utilisent les paradis fiscaux, et de loin. C'est un échantillon qui est extraordinaire parce qu'on arrive à voir des choses qui ont toujours été secrètes jusqu'à maintenant, qu'on n'avait jamais vues. Le secret est essentiel dans cette industrie-là, et je crois que c'est très clair que la plupart des gens qui ont fait affaire avec les firmes desquelles on a reçu ces fuites-là n'auraient jamais imaginé qu'un jour, tout ça, ça allait se retrouver entre les mains de journalistes. Alors, une fois qu'on a vu, on a commencé à fouiller là-dedans, il s'agissait de voir où il y avait des sujets sur lesquels on avait de l'information, parce que ça varie énormément. Il y a certains cas, certains noms pour lesquels on a très peu d'informations, ou d'autres, on a beaucoup plus d'informations sur les transactions, des courriels, des communications internes, des informations sur certains transferts financiers, par exemple, dans certains cas. Et en regardant ça, d'abord, on s'est rendu compte que les documents étaient tout à fait authentiques. D'ailleurs, depuis la publication, il n'y a personne qui a remis en question l'authenticité de ces documents-là. Tout à fait valide. Et on s'est rendu compte aussi que le secret était hyper important dans toutes ces transactions-là. Il y avait beaucoup de messages qui laissaient entendre qu'il fallait garder les choses le plus secret possible. Les questions maintenant, qu'est-ce qu'on retrouve dans cette base de données-là? Qu'est-ce que ça nous a permis de voir? Est-ce qu'on retrouve de l'évasion fiscale? Est-ce qu'il y a de la fraude là-dedans? Alors, dans bien des cas, c'est difficile de dire parce que de mettre de l'argent dans un paradis fiscal à l'étranger, c'est tout à fait légal, en autant que les revenus soient déclarés au gouvernement canadien, par exemple, ici. Et nous, comme journalistes, en tant que journalistes, on n'a pas accès aux déclarations d'impôts des particuliers. Donc, on peut soulever des questions, on peut montrer que des gens ont utiliser des véhicules offshore, des fiducies ou des choses comme ça, mais souvent, on ne peut pas nécessairement dire qu'il y a de l'évasion fiscale sans en être sûr à 100%. Ce qu'on peut voir, c'est qu'il y a des signaux. Dans un des cas, par exemple, on pouvait voir qu'il y avait plusieurs indications du propriétaire de la fiducie de s'assurer qu'aucune autorité ne soit au courant. Ce qu'on a retrouvé aussi, il y a potentiellement beaucoup de cas d'évasion fiscale et ce sont les gouvernements qui vont être à même de pouvoir faire enquête là-dessus et aller au bout des choses. Ce qu'on a trouvé également, c'est des cas de fraude. Alors, beaucoup de fraudeurs se sont retrouvés dans la base de données. On a vu des systèmes de blanchiment d'argent où les sociétés offshore étaient utilisées pour faire ça à partir de Canadiens. Il y a quelques histoires qu'on a diffusées là-dessus déjà. Une qui touche un cas de fraude énorme qui s'est passé en Russie, où les fraudeurs ont utilisé des sociétés offshore basées aux îles Vierges britanniques qui ont été créées, dans le fond, par une de ces deux firmes-là, une firme qui était dirigée par un Canadien, d'ailleurs. Alors, Ce qui est intéressant, c'est d'entendre le discours des juridictions offshore et du monde de cette industrie offshore qui dit, bon, dans le fond, il n'y a pas vraiment de problème, ça se fait, c'est tout à fait légal, il y a des contrôles, on s'assure qu'on vérifie l'identité des clients avec lesquels on fait affaire. Et dans la réalité, ce qu'on a vu à travers les données, pour une des firmes, il y avait un plus grand respect de ces règles-là, mais pour l'autre, il n'y avait virtuellement aucune vérification des clients avec qui ils faisaient affaire. Donc, ils se fiaient sur des intermédiaires qui étaient basés dans d'autres pays pour ramasser l'information, que ce soit photocopie de passeport, des choses. Et on parle d'informations de base, là, vraiment. De copies de relevés d'hydro, par exemple, pour vérifier l'adresse de quelqu'un. Alors, ce n'est pas une vérification qui est très poussée, mais même ça, la firme ne le faisait pas. Et quand on regarde dans la base de données, souvent, on n'arrive jamais à voir qui est le propriétaire ultime de ces sociétés-là. La firme elle-même ne le savait pas. Et c'est leur rôle. Eux doivent détenir cette information-là selon ces juridictions-là, comme dans les îles Vierges britanniques. Donc, il y a le discours qu'on entend et la réalité qu'on a vue derrière ces données-là était complètement différente. On s'est rendu, donc une des firmes était aux îles Vierges britanniques, on s'est rendu sur place. L'autre firme était aux îles Cook, qui est un paradis fiscal reconnu pour ses fiducies de protection des avoirs. Alors, les gens qui veulent s'assurer que leurs ex-conjoints ou conjointes ne puissent pas avoir accès à une partie de leurs fonds vont. Beaucoup de gens ont utilisé les îles Cook pour faire ça. Et donc, on s'est rendu dans ces deux pays-là. On a confronté les autorités aux îles Vierges britanniques. On a voulu obtenir une entrevue. Pendant des semaines, on s'était fait dire qu'on allait pouvoir obtenir quelque chose. Et une fois sur place, lorsqu'on était devant les bureaux de l'autorité financière là-bas, on a attendu pendant 3 heures et les gens sont cachés à l'intérieur. Ils ont absolument refusé de nous parler. On est allé voir le gouvernement des îles Vierges britanniques. On leur a expliqué la démarche, qu'est-ce qu'on faisait, que c'était important d'avoir leur réaction. Et en bout de ligne, tout ce qui a été émis, c'était un commentaire d'un paragraphe qui disait finalement que les îles Vierges britanniques respectaient toutes les normes internationales. Du côté du gouvernement canadien, alors on essaie d'obtenir d'informations ici sur les accusations. On voulait savoir si le gouvernement canadien avait réussi à mener des causes contre des gens qui faisaient de l'évasion fiscale. Et on a eu énormément de difficultés à obtenir cette information-là. Ce qui est quand même étonnant parce que quand quelqu'un est reconnu coupable d'évasion fiscale, l'Agence du revenu du Canada publie leur nom sur leur site Web et disent que puisqu'il y a eu condamnation, que c'est de l'information qui est publique, Et il publie ça pour agir comme effet pour dissuasif, dans le fond. Et tout ce qu'ils nous ont dit, c'est qu'il y a 44 cas dans les dernières années où il y a eu des condamnations. Et on voulait avoir une idée de ces cas-là pour vraiment les vérifier. Et le gouvernement a complètement refusé de nous donner accès à des cas qui, normalement, sont tout à fait publics, l'information qui est publique. Alors, on a eu de la difficulté de ce côté-là. Et après, et d'ailleurs, on a aussi fait une demande d'entrevue avec le ministère, l'Agence du revenu et tout ça a été refusé complètement. Donc, le gouvernement ne voulait pas s'avancer publiquement là-dessus. Une fois que la diffusion du reportage, une fois que les reportages sont allés en ondes, à travers le monde d'ailleurs, pas juste au Canada, il y a eu un impact, ça a eu une résonance à travers le monde, mais ici au Canada, plutôt que d'essayer de changer les choses, de mettre d'autres ressources pour aller s'attaquer à l'évasion fiscale, le gouvernement a décidé de s'attaquer à Radio-Canada. Et on s'est retrouvé avec une lettre qui a été envoyée au président de Radio-Canada, nous demandant de remettre entre les mains des autorités canadiennes la base de données. Qu'on leur donne. Et évidemment, Ça a été une demande qui a été faite dans quelques autres pays aussi, auprès de l'ICIJ à Washington, et la réponse a été de dire qu'on n'est pas là pour faire comme informateur du gouvernement, comme indépendance journalistique. C'est important pour nous pour conserver l'identification de nos sources, mais également pour s'assurer que les gens soient confiants quand ils viennent nous voir, qu'on ne met pas ça directement entre les mains de la police ou du gouvernement. Donc, comme principe journalistique, c'est très important pour nous. Et ça déplaçait le problème aussi parce que là, c'était comme tout d'un coup, c'est CBC Radio-Canada qui refuse d'aider le gouvernement de s'attaquer aux gens qui font de l'évasion fiscale. Alors que si le gouvernement avait voulu avoir cette base de données-là, les informations qu'on a eues, c'est qu'ils auraient très bien pu l'avoir. Et d'ailleurs, le gouvernement britannique a cette base de données depuis 2010. Le gouvernement australien aussi et l'IRS aux États-Unis. Et ça, on a appris ça il y a quelques semaines. Ces trois pays-là ont ce qu'on croit est essentiellement la même base de données, peut-être avec un peu plus d'informations que ce que nous, on a reçu. Et si le gouvernement britannique l'a entre les mains, c'est un peu étonnant que le gouvernement canadien ne l'ait pas non plus. Alors, j'imagine que c'est quelque chose qui a dû être ou qui sera fait dans un avenir rapproché. Alors, tout ça pour dire que jusqu'à maintenant, quand il y a eu des fuites importantes, il y a eu quelques fuites dans le passé, on pense à Kieber, et puis il y a eu deux grosses fuites en Europe, en Suisse et au Liechtenstein. Et ces fuites-là ont été remises entre les mains des gouvernements directement. Et dans ce cas-ci, la différence, c'est que ce sont des journalistes qui ont reçu ces fuites-là et nous rendons ça public. Et ça fait une grosse différence parce qu'il ne peut pas avoir une entente entre la personne qui s'est fait pincer par le gouvernement et on n'entend jamais parler. Ici, quand on fait un reportage, ça va en ondes, c'est public. Tout le monde peut en entendre parler. Et brièvement, juste pour vous indiquer que la suite des choses, on continue à travailler là-dessus. Il y a énormément d'histoires encore sur lesquelles on travaille. Dans les prochaines semaines, dans les prochains mois, à l'automne prochain aussi. Et du côté de l'ICIJ, il y a eu toujours un désir de rendre public une partie de l'information. Et je peux vous dire que ce projet-là est en voie de se réaliser, puis vous allez en entendre parler à l'avenir bientôt aussi.
Thank you so much. I did wonder when I heard about that the governments had been sitting on all that information for so long that if ICIJ hadn't brought it to the public, would we have ever learned about that?
Right, exactly.
So thank you for bringing that up. Our last speaker for the evening before we open up to questions is Diana Gibson. She's the research director for the Parkland Institute and has an extensive background in social and fiscal policy research. She's engaged nationally and internationally on topics ranging from healthcare and energy to the environment and international trade agreements. Will you join me in welcoming our last speaker?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me here. Merci beaucoup, mesdames et messieurs. C'est très bien d'être de nouveau ici à Montréal. Merci beaucoup d'avoir participé à ce sujet assez important. It's my pleasure to be back here in Montreal again. I did study at McGill, so it's nice to be back. I just wanted to mention that was an old bio that was pulled, and I am no longer the research director at Parkland, though I still engage very actively with them on a research agenda. But I am the president of the board of directors at Canadians for Tax Fairness and run a policy organization called Policy Link, as well as another cooperative, a research cooperative called the Firelight Group. So what I want to talk a little bit about to start with is bringing this a little bit home to Canada. And it's not that hard to do, of course, because just in the Senate scandals of late, and it is hard to follow an investigative journalist talking about international intrigue and scandal. But you know, Canada hasn't been short on that of late, and. So the Senate issue, and I want to start by saying that the issues of Senate expense scandal and offshoring isn't a story of government corruption. It's a bigger story, and the tax havens issues ties in. It's a story of privilege, of an elite that has decided that it is above the law, above paying taxes. And it ties in with both the large corporations and the wealthy that are beyond paying taxes and engage in not just offshoring, but tax avoidance here at home. So it's really important to bring the story away from government corruption, which serves a right-wing agenda of undermining citizen confidence in democratic governments, but instead to look at the real elitism and privilege driving this. And what does that come from? It comes from a narrative, a powerful narrative, that the wealthy and the corporations, it's this paternalistic story that the wealthy and corporations are just better at managing money than the rest of us. And that for that reason, they should have more of it, because they will use it for the betterment of all of our society. And this ties into this metaphor and a narrative, ties into the myths that the wealthy and the corporations are using it for productive investment that creates jobs and stimulates economic growth. And we still hear that story day after day today in the media. If you raise taxes, we'll lose jobs. But the offshoring story brings the lie home. They are not using that money here in Canada for productive investment. They're not buying local goods and services that create jobs. They're offshoring it. I was going to speak more about the cutting of taxes here in Canada as well, and it seems so odd that the corporations have been still continuing to lobby hard for tax cuts, because they're not paying them. But still, they are continuing to lobby hard for tax cuts. It's not just the offshoring of money that's taken money out of the productive economy. Even corporations that have declared those profits here in Canada are accumulating assets instead of investing in productive investment, and they're sitting on $500 billion in cash assets today that have been used for speculative investment, a big part of which was what drove the financial crisis, was this massive pile of cash assets that are pushing speculative investment instead of being put into productive investment in the local economy. So where does this story come from? Why is this narrative still so powerful? And I think it's really important to look at where this comes from. And, it's been driving the push for tax cuts, and we've seen since 1981 corporate taxes cut by over 60%. And same with personal income taxes at the top end. We saw them cut from in the 43% range for the highest income bracket down to 29%. Corporate taxes from 47% down to 15%. And so we've seen this massive cut in tax rates on higher income and on corporations across Canada. Also a massive increase in tax loopholes and exemptions. This wasn't just some kind of inherent shift in our economy that we shifted from the 1970s, where we were expanding social programs and raising tax rates and had income tax rates in the 47% range, corporate tax rates in the 49% range. It wasn't some inherent societal shift that we thought, oh, that was wrong, let's move away from high tax rates. It was a concerted and coordinated initiative by a right-wing movement that was launched in 1971 by Lewis Powell in the Lewis Powell memo. If you haven't read it, it's online. It's a manifesto of how to organize a concerted right-wing movement. And it ranged from things like taking over university administrations to hijacking and blackmailing media and litigation. Like it ran the gamut of a campaign strategy. And he wrote this letter. Lewis Powell was on the board of 11 corporations at the time in the United States, CEO of some, and he wrote this memo talking about the attack on the enterprise system. He said, no thoughtful person can question that America's economic system is under broad attack. We are not dealing with a sporadic, isolated attack from a relatively few extremists or even a minority socialist cadre, rather an assault on the enterprise system, broadly based and consistently pursued. And so his sense that in the 70s, when the welfare state was being expanded, that there was an attack on the enterprise system, he wrote this call to arms, this manifesto, and he wrote it to his friend Eugene Sidnor Jr., the chairman of the Education Committee at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce took up this call to arms, organized a coordinated campaign. One of its henchmen was Grover Norquist, key advisor to the Bush administration, whose famous quote sums it up nicely, "I don't want to abolish government, I just want to drown it in the bathtub." And whose follow-up quote was, "How do you shrink government? You starve the beast. You cut off its revenue source." And so began the war on taxes, the campaign to undermine people's willingness to pay taxes was set up by a movement that wanted to see the public sector shrink so there was more space for the private sector. And I think it's really important to look at how they've demonized taxes. They coined the term tax burden, and even the National Institute for Poverty in Canada talks about tax burden. They coined this phrase where you shouldn't ever say taxes without saying burden, just like you shouldn't say coal without saying clean. And so they, in their manifesto, they not only developed a new terminology, but a new narrative, and also a broad, well-funded national-level and international-level campaign. And it was very successful. Corporate profits have been rising since as a share of the economy, as middle incomes have stagnated. CEO and high-level executive compensation has been skyrocketing. And so we've seen a shift in the share of our economy that's going to corporations and the wealthy. We've also seen that that's been moving offshore and that they haven't been paying taxes on it. So the impact of this is rising inequality. And what we've seen is that inequality across Canada and across nations has been going up as a result, as social programs have been shrinking. Inequality is bad not just for society. We've seen it in the spirit level by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. They wrote a great book that showed the correlation of inequality with social ills, all of them, rising obesity rates, higher rates of incarceration, higher rates of violent crime, higher infant mortality rates, lower levels of life expectancy. Across the board, they are correlated with higher inequality. But not just social ills, also economic. Our economy is actually damaged by higher rates of inequality. The International Monetary Fund did a study looking at inequality and other factors tied to economic growth. And they assumed that things like political stability, tax, tariff levels, trade openness, exchange rate competitiveness, that those usual mantras of economists would be the drivers of economic growth. And to their surprise, the most robust correlation was inequality. The most robust correlation with duration of economic growth, out of all of them, was distribution of income. So we've seen that inequality isn't just bad for us socially and for quality of life of all, but it's also bad for our economy, which is why the International Monetary Fund, the OECD, the Conference Board of Canada, these bastions of left-wing thought, have been telling us to actually raise tax rates on the wealthy and to close tax loopholes, which is why we formed the Canadians for Tax Fairness. The organization is galvanizing a national movement in Canada to try and reclaim fairness in our tax system. It's been working very hard, especially Dennis Howlett, our executive director, on public education campaigns, developing resources, exposing issues of tax havens, working with international campaigns to close those gaps. We're launching a closing tax loopholes campaign here in Canada. And so the organization has been working on the ground to build movements in provinces across Canada to reclaim tax fairness. And I'm sure each of the campaigns that have been talked about today around tax havens is accessible online. I encourage all of you to engage either directly through joining and participating in the organizations trying to bring justice to our tax system, or through getting more informed on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So much content in here, so I won't take too much time. I do want to thank each of the panelists again for giving us a lot of information and a lot to think about. And I now invite you to the microphone if you have a question. And as is the moderator's job, to have a question if no one else has one. So I do have one, but I do see someone coming to the microphone, so I'll hang on to mine. Maybe it will come out, and I'll turn it over to the floor. Can you, you're okay there? Can you, yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, but there are a few things that I don't understand. First of all, I'm not aware, I'm not sure if you know that Harper doesn't want to join the other OECD countries in putting some restraints on this tax evasion. And I don't know, Avaz today sent a petition, but I don't know how effective this petition will be anyway. My question is, I did not quite understand how it is that the third world countries are paying the debt of the first world countries, something like that. Also, how the rise of China and the other developing will have an impact on tax evasion. I didn't quite get that.
Thanks for your question. I think James, that maybe goes to you. Yeah.
Well, what I was suggesting is that the when you take a look at the balance sheet for developing world as a whole and compare it with rich countries, that basically rich countries are net creditors, net debtors compared to the low and middle income countries, taking into account all the off. Yeah, sorry. When you take into account all of the offshore wealth that citizens from the developing world have parked abroad in mainly Western banks and first world capitals like City of London, Zurich, and New York, most of which don't generate any tax revenue for those home countries. And you compare all that wealth with the debt of developing countries, and you also take into account the huge amounts of official reserves that developing countries have accumulated because of they couldn't rely on the IMF and the World Bank. Then, in effect, the number is something on the order of $11 trillion that the developing world is lending, essentially, to first world countries. And so that just makes it clear that the problem they're facing is being able to tax all this offshore wealth. They have the same problem with the corporations that are doing business there in many cases. John has a great story about the banana industry. Banana industry dominated by a cartel that basically arranges its offshore companies so that they consume all of the value added between the production cost of the banana and the retail price. So there's nothing to tax because it's all been parked in havens. Lots of examples of where the haven system is basically contributing not only to inequality and poverty in first world countries, but also to developing countries as well, making it much more difficult for them to have income taxes.
Does this work? With regards to Stephen Harper, he actually was quoted as saying that the U.S. anti-tax movement was a shining light for Canadians. And then he's also been quoted as saying there's no tax is a good tax. So he is the poster boy for the anti-tax movement and thus will continue to be obdurate at the international tables when it comes to initiatives that are attempting to bring home any kind of tax fairness or shine any kind of transparency or accountability on the tax havens. As much as you said, you doubt the effectiveness of the letter writing campaign that Avaaz has put out, it's going to be really important to continue to bring that pressure to bear on the Harper government, because he's been very clear on his, and it's also going to be really important to expose his agenda at those tables.
I just wanted to say the talks were fantastic, and I think you guys are all fighting the good fight, so my hat's off to you. What I wanted to ask is if anyone on the panel is familiar with the concept of Bitcoin and distributed peer-to-peer currencies, and whether or not that represents a new front in the fight against fiscal flight and tax evasion. Like, what if technology basically makes offshore tax havens obsolete, and you could have an offshore tax haven on your own hard drive? And is that kind of commensurate with the problems you experience with taxation of transnational corporations and, you know, the issues of different jurisdictions and all that stuff? Like, has anyone put any thought into that?
Well, as you know, Bitcoin has had its ups and downs this year if you've been following the stock market. So there was a period in which this question was perhaps taken more seriously than it is today by tax authorities. There is an issue about, as you have electronic currencies develop, and also new forms of exchange developed, and with new centers that are, you know, basically off the grid, whether, you know, you open it up to the very sophisticated players being able to make markets without ever going through things you can monitor. I don't see any absolute solution to that, but I do think that governments are clearly aware of it, and that's what regulation is all about. So, you know, we hope that they are on the right side on this issue. It's going to be a continuing battle, though, because elites have access to technologies first and foremost, and they have a vested interest necessarily in, you know, hollowing out the state. So that's the issue.
Hello, good evening. Is this working? Yeah. I have two questions, actually. The first one is about the fact that multinational corporations are not defined at law. They are structured as corporations domestically, but internationally or transnationally, they are entities that law does not define. So, and this is related to the issue of transfer pricing that you have mentioned. So, the first question is: can you tell us a bit about that? And also, do you have any intuition about the amount of money that is involved in transfer pricing or mispricing practices? And the second question, and it's related, it's the issue of legal experts in and experts generally, but I think legal experts play an important role in enabling this whole offshore system. So if you have a word to say on that, I would be very happy to hear about it. Thanks.
We don't have a global figure for the scale of transfer mispricing. Christian Aid in the UK have come up with a figure of $160 billion of mispricing simply from the non-OECD poorer countries. So they're losing out $160 billion a year from trade mispricing, from transfer mispricing. And that's arguably only part of the picture, because you have to add onto that other forms of trade mispricing not happening within multinational companies, in other words, beyond transfer mispricing and into the area of reinvoicing and many of the other uses. I have to say that when I was doing my own investigations, working for a an organization called Deloitte Touche in Jersey, much of the activity that I was looking at involved reinvoicing rather than transfer mispricing. That is, using apparently third-party, unrelated third-party companies to reinvoice trade in order to shift the profits offshore. And that's the scale of reinvoicing is proving very, very difficult indeed to investigate. So the transfer mispricing is only one part of the equation. I think it's time that we got a little bit serious about, you know, the nature of transnational corporations. I'm still getting my head around the fact that Apple appear to be operating through corporations which aren't registered anywhere. Apple, La La Land, or whatever. Look, transnational corporations need to be treated as single units. And as I've said earlier, I think the way we now need to move is to require them to produce accounts as single units, a combined report, and to require them to break down their combined report on a country-by-country basis so we have a clearer idea of where they operate. And one of the biggest problems that I, as an investigator, have had, and I'm sure Jim and others have exactly the same problem, is knowing who we're dealing with in many of the poorer countries. At one stage, I was investigating what appeared to be a case of market abuse in the cement and aggregates market in Kenya, where there appeared to be four companies, separate companies, competing, apart from the fact that we had inside knowledge which said that all four companies were under single control. It was the French company Lafarge. They owned all four companies. It was a market rigging exercise. So one of the things that we hope that country-by-country reporting will do is to actually reveal basic information about who are we dealing with, who are behind these companies. But offshore enables market rigging to happen on a massive scale in many countries. Now, the role of facilitators, I mean, don't get me started, where do we begin? You know, law firms, the world's biggest law firms are up to their eyeballs in this one. They're up to next in it. Deloitte Touche, all the big four accounting firms, and the next tier down are all very heavily involved. What can one say? My friend Prem Sekar in United Kingdom came forward with a report recently. He had some inside information on one of the big four accounting firms, which revealed that they had worked out that many of their tax avoidance schemes had a 75% likelihood of failing if challenged by the revenue. But they went ahead and sold it anyway because the fees were too good. This came up ahead of the Public Accounts Committee, and this is the House of Commons Committee that's making some great investigations into this. And the other three of the big four accounting firms said, well, no, we're not nearly that bad. We just sell our products when we think there's only a 50% likelihood of them failing. Well, that's okay. That gives you some idea of how corrupted, and it is corrupt, to start flogging tax avoidance schemes when you know there's a 50% likelihood they won't pass the revenue. But the money's too good. And then let's look at some of the big banks. I've always had a thing about Barclays, but I've got a particular thing at the moment about HSBC, and I'm really hoping that the US authorities will finally move against HSBC. Anyone who knows about the history of HSBC, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, knows that it goes back to the Opium Wars. That's where it made its money. It was, of course, the funder of the Opium Wars. Yeah, in the late 19th century, and it never moved on from being a money laundering front. It remains a criminal organization, and I have a particular grudge against them because, of course, we've had the huge revelations, you know, about what they were doing in Mexico and their Geneva branch and their Jersey branch, and all of this happened under the watch of a guy called Stephen Green, Reverend Stephen Green. The Reverend Lord Stephen Green, who is a minister in the UK cabinet at the moment. All of this happened under his watch. In other words, he was responsible for the criminal activities in Mexico, in Geneva, and in Jersey. And there's no apology. There's no attempt at remorse. You know, this is a criminal organization. It's paid the largest fine ever in history. If it goes through to criminal charges or civil charges in America, it is more than likely that they, as an organization, will fail. Jim, you might want to comment on that. But they're too big to jail. And this is the really frightening prospect that we have. We have a U.S. prosecutor who didn't want to proceed with prosecution because he feared, why should a prosecutor worry about this? He feared it might lead to a systemic collapse. But that's nothing. Not the job of a prosecutor to worry about systemic collapse. The prosecutor's got to take the evidence available and decide whether or not there's sufficient evidence to go ahead with a criminal prosecution. But the problem of too big to jail applies right the way across the board now. So I think, you know, you've raised some very big problems. The facilities are right up to their necks in it, and we've really got to look at how we can cleanse our legal profession, our accounting professions, and our banking professions of this kind of monkey business.
Let me say just a word about, I know there's more questions, but Carl Kazin at Princeton used to say that business computers will never replace business people because business people don't know what they're doing. But in this area, I think that Apple and Google and Microsoft and GE and all these other big companies in the offshoring market have known exactly what they're doing. They're taking advantage of a whole new regime for offshore taxation. It was basically created by the U.S. Treasury at the end of the 1990s, the Clinton administration, one of their least successful policy changes. And it encouraged companies to migrate their intellectual capital, their brands and patents, offshore to places like Ireland with lower tax rates, and then to, in turn, put them even further away in places like Bermuda. We have numbers on that. The estimates in the film We're Not Broke last year was about $70 to $100 billion a year lost to the U.S. Treasury alone because of this digital offshoring. That's just one example. I mean, there are many kinds of transfer pricing abuse. The conventional side, as John mentioned, somewhere in the order of $160 to $200 billion a year of lost tax revenue. And then there's a new thing that we found out by looking at Switzerland as a rebooker of corporate profits from trade with countries like Zambia, where they're actually... you find export over-invoicing because Zambia shows copper exports to Switzerland. Switzerland shows no copper imports from Zambia. And what they're doing is the Swiss company that's gotten itself in the middle is basically parking the profits from the Zambian copper trade in the BVI. So Zambia gets no money from that. If Zambia got the same price for its copper that Switzerland does, its GDP would increase by 25%. So this has a real impact. And this is the thing that economists need to get involved in. So those of you who are here for the researcher program tomorrow, I encourage you to. There are 1,000 questions like this that need to be answered. It just takes investigative economics to do it.
Can I ask questions? No? I'm just a law student at McGill, so my question may sound very superficial. So my first question is that you mentioned that there's like first world doesn't really care about the developing countries, and then like developing countries end up lending money to them but not generate a lot of tax because of the offshore thing. But like as far as I know that a lot of Chinese companies, they will not invest in, you know, like Canada or U.S. They directly invest or not invest but open offshore companies in Hong Kong, BVI, or Barbados because they have lower tax rate or even zero tax rate. So I don't see that there's the losing of the loss of the credibility has like much to do with the developed countries not giving information to developing countries like China and India. It's more like, I guess, the direct investment or offshore companies in tax havens. So I don't see that logic there. And then my second question is that I see that there's between countries, there are tax treaties. For example, there's tax treaties between Canada and Barbados. And then in those tax treaties, normally the shareholders' dividend has like lower withholding tax for maybe from 5 to 10%. Sometimes I see it as a, you know, the government is sort of encouraging offshore company to open offshore company because they are giving lower tax rate for, so I don't know if, you know, the government's real, maybe they want to get the money back eventually, because if the shareholders don't get the money, then the money is not in Canada or any other country. But I see it in a different way. I don't know if my understanding is correct. Thanks.
Let me address the tax treaty issue. I was just talking to the Ministry of Finance in the Netherlands about their extraordinary network of tax treaties. And they have more than 80 tax treaty agreements. And as there's a study that will be published this week by one of our researchers called, whose name is Francis Weizik, about treaty shopping. And this is where the original purpose of tax treaties, which was to reduce sort of risk of double taxation for investors, is being misused by third parties who are able to take advantage of the treaty system. And he shows that there's an extraordinary increase in the use of the Netherlands for treaty shopping, generating no benefits to the parties involved, very few benefits to the Netherlands, and enormous benefits and costs to developing countries that are finding their own tax revenues reduced directly. And so I put it to them, you know, the Netherlands is getting a lot of bad press these days. Can we just do something about this one? You know, maybe you could. And I said, there's three treaties where the Netherlands is the only party: Indonesia, Philippines, and Ghana. You could add limitation of benefit clauses to those treaties immediately overnight. And get rid of the problem. And they said, that's interesting. Maybe we'll take that under consideration. But they said, well, in Indonesia's case, the problem is the government. We don't really understand why the Indonesian government doesn't want to get rid of these special benefits for third parties, but there's something going on there. So as you open these kimonos, you sometimes see lots of, you expose other problems within, problems of corruption and so forth. But I invite us all to dig into the tax treaty system because it is a can of worms being misused.
Yeah, can I just... I didn't fully understand the first point you were making, particularly about Chinese use of BVI, which, of course, is very famous. And it's an interesting question for research. Why is the BVI the largest, after Hong Kong, the largest source of foreign direct investment into China? What's happening here? I mean, have you been to the British Virgin Islands? There's no Chinese investment there, apart from maybe a Chinese restaurant or two. There's no genuine investment in BVI because of its low tax. BVI is being used by Chinese companies for round-tripping of capital back into China, dressed up as foreign direct investment. And we see similar patterns with Mauritius being used by Indians, again, round-tripping their capital offshore via Mauritius, and it comes back into India dressed up as foreign direct investment with all the tax breaks that foreign direct investment is able to attract. So there's a really important area for research in the way in which BVI and Mauritius and various other centres. I was looking at Brazil in the late 1990s, and huge inflows and outflows of Brazilian capital to the Cayman Islands. So I think this is an area which merits a great deal more research.
Thank you.
Bonjour, bonsoir. Ma question est particulièrement pour Frédéric Salak. Et bien sûr, si John, si les autres conférenciers voulaient donner votre impression. Ici au Canada, comme on sait, depuis mars 2013, le gouvernement canadien a introduit un système de délation en vertu duquel les délateurs sont rémunérés jusqu'à l'ordre de 15% du fruit de leur délation. J'ai posé la question à plusieurs personnes pour avoir leurs impressions jusqu'à présent, s'ils trouvaient que c'était une bonne chose ou s'ils trouvaient que la rémunération était trop élevée ou si on avait besoin de ça au Canada ou si, bon, etc. Je pensais que, Frédéric, vous étiez la personne parfaite pour nous donner vos impressions là-dessus jusqu'à présent.
Donc, on n'a pas réclamé la prime de délation après la diffusion du reportage. C'est un système qui est utilisé, je crois, aux États-Unis, si je ne me trompe pas. Il y a d'autres pays qui ont décidé d'avoir des primes de délation comme celle-là, beaucoup plus élevées que ce que le Canada propose. C'est certainement un pas, probablement dans la bonne direction, mais dans l'ensemble, les solutions qui ont été soulignées ce soir par John, par James aussi, d'accords automatiques d'échange d'informations avec ces pays-là permettraient au Canada d'avoir l'information à la source, de pouvoir savoir immédiatement qu'il y a une fiducie qui a été ouverte aux îles Cook par un Canadien. Et ça, comme effet dissuasif, ça pourrait avoir un impact probablement beaucoup plus grand que la question de la délation. Mais c'est sûr que la délation fait partie des outils qui n'étaient pas là jusqu'à maintenant. Et nous-mêmes, on s'en est rendu compte après la diffusion du reportage. On a eu plusieurs appels d'ex-conjointes qui avaient des choses à dire au sujet de leur ex-mari et étaient intéressés à savoir si le nom de cet ex-mari-là se trouvait peut-être dans la base de données. Et je peux vous dire que dans certains cas, oui. Alors, on poursuit, on continue des histoires là-dessus. Et tout ça pour dire que le gouvernement pourrait profiter aussi de ce genre d'informations-là, certainement, si le public sent qu'il y a vraiment une conviction, un désir de faire des changements, ce qui n'a pas nécessairement été le cas jusqu'à maintenant, ce qu'on a vu dans les politiques du gouvernement ici. Si un changement vraiment sérieux du côté de l'approche du gouvernement, bien, ça va peut-être inciter plus de gens à révéler des secrets comme ça.
We are at 9 o'clock, so I'm going to take one. It looks like we have one last question, and we'll take the last question. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Si l'étudiante en droit trouvait sa question simple, la mienne est simpliste. Les propositions qui sont amenées pour régler le problème des paradis fiscaux sont un petit peu complexes à comprendre. Et la solution, par exemple, d'imposer un taux minimal de taxation des entreprises à travers le monde ou du moins dans les réseaux de partenaires commerciaux, c'est probablement trop simple pour être une bonne solution, mais j'aimerais peut-être avoir une impression. Je ne sais pas si M. Christensen peut répondre ou les autres intervenants.
he's saying it's a simple problem, but it's hard to solve. Is there merit in asking if there's a minimum tax base? Maybe you can help make sure I caught the last part of that.
Yeah.
Did I get it?
Okay. I think that's what I understood. I don't see it as that hard a problem to solve, apart from the fact that it's, you know, if you go back to the League of Nations, which was discussing this in the 1920s and the 1930s, and there were some really excellent studies coming out, particularly coming out of Germany, around how to tax multinational companies. There were some very, very good German researchers working on this. And they all came to almost a unanimous conclusion. It isn't the technical problems, it's the political problems. It's finding the political will. That is the issue. And I go around the world and I'm talking to PricewaterhouseCoopers and all the other big accounting firms, and they all say, yeah, it's the political will issue. They all recognize that it doesn't work, and they all recognize that it's going to be very difficult to marshal political will. And so, planet Earth, we have a big problem, and they'll continue to exploit that problem and do nothing about it, and we'll suffer as a result. The big problem we face, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that there isn't an appropriate global authority to set the global rules. You'll have heard You know, you might have gathered from the tone of my discussion earlier that I don't have huge confidence in the OECD coming forward with the appropriate new guidelines and rules. I just don't. At the same time, the United Nations Committee of Experts working in this area has a staff smaller than my office, and I only have three people. So, you know, they have two people working on this, and they're hideously under-resourced. They have no political status. They're blocked by the OECD. This is a real case of an institutional failure. We need to recognize that. If we want to move forward, we need to have a serious intergovernmental agency which can set the rules, not necessarily the rates, but just the rules of the game. And those rules might take us in the direction of unitary taxation. They might take us in the direction of combined reporting and country-by-country reporting and all of that. But as long as we have the current political failure of will, we're not going to make any real headway. I just don't think that playing around with permanent establishment rules in a world where some companies can say they have establishments which are registered nowhere and everywhere. What can you do playing with permanent establishment rules? We need, in other words, we need to have a global movement, global alliance for tax justice, which will generate the public pressure to bring our politicians seriously around the table to move forward with this issue. And when I say our politicians, it must not just be G8 or G20. It must be an institution with the political authority to bring all countries together and to thrash it out. Now, even if it takes 10 years, this is what we should be aiming at, and this is what we within civil society should be pushing for: proper, lasting, durable solutions to a massive problem. Because if we fail to go in this direction, I'm convinced we will end up with tax wars every bit as bad as the kind of protectionist and the wars of exchange rates in the 1930s, and we know where that led. That's the gravity of the issue that we face.
Well, I think, we're making enormous headway here, but I'll give you an example from the front lines of this issue. Just this week, we had a kind of a truce, I guess it was fair to say. The Swiss government, supporting its banks, attempted to negotiate a kind of behind-the-scenes deal with the U.S. Department of Justice, Eric Holder in particular, in which 14 Swiss banks that are still under investigation and all 300 banks that might be under investigation if there were an infinite amount of time and resources would be given a deferred prosecution agreement like the one that UBS got in 2009 in exchange for a $10 billion fine. That was the idea. So that has so many bad aspects of it that I won't go into here, but we just did a piece about this you can find on the web. But basically, we published the article, and today the Swiss backed off and decided to go for a rolling set of settlements with individual banks rather than this global settlement, because the Justice Department told them that in these conditions they could no longer try to get a global settlement through. It wouldn't be politically acceptable. And part of that was just because of Eric Holder has gotten in all kinds of trouble. But I think part of it was also that we spotlighted this issue. We got senators, we called senators and congressmen and got them to get to work and apply some pressure to the Justice Department, saying it would be politically unacceptable to do this kind of global deferred prosecution agreement. So that's a kind of campaign that I think we need to mount. But beyond these particular longer term policy agreements, I'm encouraged by John's militancy about the unitary taxation. I think that's an issue that he's been leading the way on, and some of us have been kind of dragging our feet, saying, "Oh, is this really possible?" But he makes a very good point, which is that you set stretch targets for the movement, and you demand the impossible, and suddenly that changes the discourse, because people stop satisficing. They stop you know, making deals with the bureaucrats, and they start talking about what do we really need to do here, and that's a strategy, you know, that goes. There's a long history of progressive movements having more success ultimately by setting these difficult targets and then bringing everybody else to them. I think that's an appropriate strategy for us to adopt as a tax justice movement.
Ouais, en conclusion, le projet sur lequel j'ai travaillé, Offshore Leaks, quand on a commencé à travailler là-dessus, on s'attendait à ce qu'il y ait quand même un impact, même si la politique fiscale, ça n'attire pas normalement les foules, ça n'attire pas tellement l'attention des auditeurs. Mais dans ce cas-ci, en diffusant à travers le monde, en même temps, des informations qui nommaient des gens haut placés, les gens pouvaient voir à ce moment-là, ça vraiment, on a senti, pas juste ici au Canada, mais la réaction était très vive, les codes d'écoute ont été très élevés ici, les réactions du public à travers le monde aussi ont été importantes. Alors, en levant le voile de cette opacité-là, de ce monde-là, les gens peuvent voir vraiment qu'est-ce qui se passe derrière, et bien que toutes ces réformes étaient les efforts pour ces réformes, comme le groupe de John et James, ça fait plusieurs années qu'ils travaillent là-dessus. Mais la révélation d'Offshore League est arrivée peut-être à un moment assez précis qui a fait en sorte que les gouvernements, devant les électeurs, ont plus vraiment le choix que de se positionner publiquement et de s'attaquer à la question. Et nous, on va poursuivre encore à fouiller là-dedans, comme je le mentionnais tout à l'heure. Il y a une quantité énorme de données dans les bases de données qu'on a qui touchent la Chine, qu'on n'a pas du tout exploré encore, et plusieurs autres histoires ici au Canada aussi. Alors, comme ils disent en anglais, « stay tuned ».
I'd like to just refer back to what John Christensen said in terms of the end game here being the consequence being tax wars. I want to add that the consequence of this is being faced by Canadians and citizens every day already. Every austerity budget that we see is the cost of not getting our tax revenues either because of offshoring or because of tax avoidance or because of artificially low tax rates, and that those costs are being paid every day today by people who should be getting the programs and services that they're not. And so this opportunity that we have here today in Canada because of the exposé and done by investigative journalism, and now I get to call myself an investigative economist, which I really like. those exposés are really important because we've got a moment right now where there's momentum. And, you know, I encourage you to engage more at this because moments like this don't come along that often, where we have the political, the light has been shone on the government, the scandal is there in the media, and to bring that home to Canadians in terms of what it means for them every day in terms of foregone programs and services, and that we're paying that cost. And being able to engage more in direct on-the-ground organizing. I know Canadians for Tax Fairness has been doing a lot of backroom lobbying, as well as engaging in lots of media campaign work. But that groundwork has already been laid, but the moment is ripe right now. The ground is fertile, so I encourage you to engage. The book on Canadians by Canadians for Tax Fairness on tax fairness is available if you want more information, and there's lots of resources out there for better informed informing the public. Thank you.
Well, I think you all agree with me that this has been a stimulating and engaging beginning of a conversation. Many discussions to follow, I hope. And I hope to see many of you at the research symposium tomorrow, the Tax Justice Research Symposium tomorrow. I want to thank you all for showing up. It was a rainy evening and a cold evening, and it's really just I'm very gratified to see the interest in this topic, an important topic. And I really appreciate this panel. A lot of work has gone in to develop the ideas that were presented tonight. And I know these folks have worked on these issues for a long time, and they have a long road ahead of them. So will you amend applaudissements, s'il vous plaît, for nos panelists. Thank you very much.